From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
People everywhere, are fed up with government, fed up with politicians, fed up with the two old parties. They, like us, are ready for a credible program that will actually do something for a change, to not slow the rate of growth of government, not freeze the government, but to turn around and send it in the other direction as fast as possible, to a government a fraction of the size of what we have today. We are not alone. The American people are on our side. We are the mainstream now.
Libertarian presidential candidate Harry Brown joins us live. And former Colorado Governor Dick Lam announces his presidential bid on the Reform Party ticket.
When you look at Social Security and Medicare, when you look at the civil rights movement, the women's movement, I think the Democratic Party has always been in the forefront of change. But I feel it's right now looking in the rearview mirror. This country has staggering problems. It's not facing them. I believe also that it's become just simply another special interest party. I think both political parties are controlled by special interest money, and I've had enough of it.
All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now!, public broadcasting's only daily election show. I'm Amy Goodman. Bob Dole has angered the NAACP by declining an invitation to speak at the civil rights group's annual convention today. He says he has a major scheduling problem. This morning, he'll be addressing police in Virginia. This afternoon, he meets with Pennsylvania Governor Tom Ridge. Ridge's name has been bandied about as a possible vice presidential running mate. He's also been criticized by many activists for signing the death warrant for black journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal. And retired General Colin Powell said yesterday he does not plan to campaign for Bob Dole or any other GOP candidates this fall, although he does support the presumptive Republican nominee.
There may be opportunities for me to appear from time to time with Senator Dole, and I certainly look forward to opportunities to talk with him and give him advice.
Meanwhile, after much political maneuvering, the Senate votes today on a minimum wage hike. Democrats want to boost the wage by 90 cents an hour to $5.15, but Republicans want to put off the hike until January, and they would exempt millions of short-time workers and workers at small businesses. Yesterday, Maryland Democratic Senator Paul Sarbanes attacked the GOP amendments, including the one that would exempt businesses with revenues of less than $500,000 a year.
That's two-thirds of all businesses in the country. That's over 10 million employees, most of whom are now covered by the minimum wage. So while you would appear on the one hand to be giving something by raising the minimum wage, you actually would be taking it back with the other hand. And that needs to be clearly understood. There are many millions of workers now covered by the minimum wage who, under this amendment, would not receive the benefit of the increase in the minimum wage that's called for here.
President Clinton is vowing to veto any hike that has big exemptions. The International Conference on AIDS is taking place in British Columbia. Meanwhile, in Washington, President Clinton is getting some praise and some criticism from his Presidential Advisory Council on HIV/AIDS. The group says the Clinton administration may be the best when it comes to battling the deadly disease, but at the same time, it says the administration has been overly timid in pushing aggressive prevention programs such as needle exchanges for drug addicts. This news from South Carolina. A volunteer firefighter who helped battle a blaze that destroyed a rural black church in 1994 has been charged with starting the fire. Also yesterday, two Ku Klux Klan members already facing state arson charges in the burnings of two black churches were charged in federal court in connection with one of the blazes. In Georgia, today is Judgment Day for Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney. The Supreme Court struck down the majority African-American district that elected the young, outspoken, progressive black woman to be its representative in Washington, D.C. This time around, McKinney is battling for her political life in a majority white district. And she's running against three white males in a district that once elected House Speaker Newt Gingrich. McKinney told Pacifica's Verna Avery Brown that she knows today's election is a test of whether white voters in the South will cross the color line and support a black candidate.
That is the challenge that has been set forward by the United States Supreme Court. I believe that as Georgia welcomes the world now for the Olympics, that we're going to demonstrate a strong and vibrant democracy to the world that is appreciative of everybody.
Does this mean, Representative McKinney, that you'll have to restructure your message somewhat to speak directly to the interest of the white constituents in the 4th District?
What it means is that the message won't be reconstructed because I've guided myself on principle. But what it does mean is that there will be new voices and a new chorus of support out there that previously was not there, or maybe that was always there, but we didn't know it was there, and now they will join in the push to make sure that Georgia is not the state that is leading our country backwards, but that Georgia is the state that is leading our country forward.
Is there any evidence that you will be able to bring whites on board? Are there any working in your campaign? Are they showing up at your rallies?
Yes. We have, I think, demonstrated that we do have white support, and we've been pleasantly surprised. I think that the folks who underestimated our biracial appeal will be surprised as well. I don't know if that'll be pleasant for them, though.
Mm-hmm. you're running against three white men. Is that a plus or a minus in your newly drawn district?
Well, I think it's a plus. I mean, it's a plus in that 59% of the voters are women.
And so you're hoping, therefore, that you will garner the bulk of the women's vote?
Well, of course, when you talk about opportunity for children, you talk about security for workers and for senior citizens, those are women's issues. Women's issues span the spectrum of all of the issues that impact individuals as well as children and families, and those are my issues.
Mm-hmm. Has race been made an issue in this campaign by any of your opponents?
Race is a factor in Georgia politics. The fact that I'm black, it is not a secret. So it's going to be a factor whether it's spoken or unspoken, but that's America.
Now, if Cynthia McKinney loses, does this mean that outspoken voice for the underrepresented will be lost in Congress?
Cynthia McKinney's not going to lose.
All right. If she wins, can she afford to speak with the same voice?
Cynthia McKinney's going to continue to speak out.
Congressmember Cynthia McKinney is one of three black Democrats in Georgia's 11-member delegation. The 2nd District's Sanford Bishop faces a similar challenge. His newly created district shrank from 52% black to 35% black, and the two men vying for his seat are both white men. The 5th District is an exception. Congressmember John Lewis is running unopposed. And you're listening to Democracy Now! This weekend in Washington, D.C., the Libertarian Party nominated Harry Brown to be its candidate for president in the 1996 elections. Brown is a resident of Tennessee who writes an investment newsletter and is the author of 9 books, including his recent campaign manifesto, Why Government Doesn't Work, and How I Found Freedom in an Unfree World. Brown joins us now to talk about his candidacy and explain what the Libertarian Party is all about. And we're joined by my co-host in New York, Juan Gonzalez, columnist with the Daily News. I want to welcome you, Harry Brown, to Democracy Now!, and why don't we begin by you just laying out your platform?
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. Government doesn't work. It doesn't deliver the mail on time. It doesn't educate our children. It doesn't keep the cities safe. And yet there's this gigantic game of let's pretend going on today. Let's pretend the war on poverty really does help poor people. Let's pretend the war on drugs is really doing something to stop drug abuse and reduce crime in this country. And in fact, government doesn't work. And so I'm making an offer to the American people everywhere. Would you give up your favorite federal programs if it meant you never had to pay income tax again? In other words, if you're getting a farm subsidy, a student loan, whatever it is, would you be willing to give that up if it meant you could escape the income tax for the rest of your life? Because what I want to do is to get the federal government out of every program that is not specified in the Constitution and use the savings to repeal the income tax and replace it with nothing. No flat tax, no sales tax, so that everything you earn will be yours to save, to spend, to give away as you see fit.
But if you were told, for example, that a kid would not go hungry, would get a school lunch, if you paid your taxes, wouldn't you be willing to pay some taxes?
I might be willing to donate money to such a fund, but I don't want it taken away from me by confiscation by the federal government and then thrown in the Atlantic Ocean by bureaucrats who then pose as the protectors of the poor and underprivileged when, in fact, they are the protectors only of their own positions. Government is a political matter. When we say, gee, wouldn't it be wonderful if we had a program to take care of people who are hungry, if we had a program to take care of people who are uneducated, whatever it is, what we're really saying is we will have a program that will be administered by or decided by Newt Gingrich, Bob Dole, Robert Byrd, Teddy Kennedy, Jesse Helms, and these people will sit around a table in Washington somewhere and divide up the spoils between them. And I don't care what the issue is, you'll wind up with a federal building in West Virginia, a new research center in Massachusetts, some kind of a subsidy for Archer Daniels Midland. In other words, whatever it is that you think the government is going to do, you are simply making it a political issue for politicians to fight over the spoils.
What is government good for?
Government is force. The only reason we ask government to do something is to force someone to do something he doesn't want to do, or to forcibly prevent him from what he wants to do, or to force him to pay for something he doesn't want to pay for. And I want to see force reduced to the absolute minimum because it is the most inefficient way of solving social problems. Any businessman can tell you that you don't get anywhere intimidating your employees. The only way you get them motivated is by making their incentives the same as yours. And the only way things get done in this world is by people freely acting with each other voluntarily in order to get what they want. We don't get anywhere by forcing people. That's why government programs don't work.
Mr. Brown, this is Juan Gonzalez in New York. I just wanted to ask you.
How do you do?
How are you doing, sir? In terms of the emphasis of the Libertarian Party in reducing the role of government, I mean, many of the current political leaders on the national scene, both Democrat and Republican, are espousing many similar ideas to you. Do you feel that you're that in essence they're attempting to co-opt libertarian ideas, or how do you clearly distinguish yourself from either President Clinton or Bob Dole?
Well, they always campaign as libertarians. There's been an anti-government revolution building in this country for 25 years, and so they come to us at election time and say, oh, boy, taxes are too high. Regulations are stifling employment in this country and hurting the inner cities. We've got to do something to reduce government back to the Constitution and so on. But then they go back to Washington, not just after the election, but the same day. They will go back to Washington and vote for a bill that's going to drive the private health insurance companies out of business, or to censor the internet, or an anti-terrorism bill that just tears up the Bill of Rights and allows DEA agents to run roughshod over the rights of black and white people in this country without any discrimination. That's one nice thing about it, is that they don't discriminate in the way that they tear up the Bill of Rights. They don't believe what they say.
But in a society with increasing polarization and conflict, ethnic conflict, racial conflict, class conflict, don't you need a mediating agent like government to some degree to be able to be influenced by all parties rather than, in essence, have an open warfare between groups in society?
Well, that's a good point. Influence is the key word. When we think we are going to get the government to do something, we are sadly mistaken, because in the final analysis, people who are more influential than us, people who are more powerful than us, people who are wealthier than us, will be the ones who actually make the decisions as to how a government program will be run. And any time the government has the right or the power to give to one group at the expense of another, then what you're going to wind up with is class warfare, racial warfare, gender warfare, as we all fight to get the government on our side, to impose our way on other people because we're scared to death that other people are going to impose their way upon us. The government has has been the biggest factor in the disharmony that exists among groups today.
Harry Brown, let me ask you this, though. You're not starting with a clean slate in this country. I mean, for example, there's a legacy of slavery. And so at this point, people begin at an unequal place. How do you even that out?
Well, the government is not going to do it. That we know for sure. Government doesn't work. None of its programs work. None of its reforms work. Nothing that it says it's going to do is going to work. The only thing we can do is to try to lift the fortunes of everybody in this country. And if we repeal the income tax, we're going to leave $1 trillion a year in the economy that is currently being sucked out in income and Social Security taxes. And when that happens, then employers are going to be scurrying all over the welfare rolls, the roles of former government employees, looking for people to satisfy an enormous shortage of labor that's going to be caused by a great new demand for goods and services. When people keep the money they earn and every dollar is theirs to spend, to save, to give away as they see fit. Finally, we will have a situation in this country also where people can get on the bottom rung of the ladder. Today, the poor people on welfare are trapped in hopelessness and despair because the tax laws, the welfare laws, the minimum wage laws, all the other regulations conspire to keep those people from ever getting out of welfare. It's not just that it has cost us trillions of dollars since the 1960s to support this tremendously destructive welfare system, but it has destroyed the lives of millions of Americans who have been trapped in hopelessness and despair, and I want to free those people finally once and for all.
You're equating there the minimum wage with welfare. Would you, for instance, right now Congress is considering raising the minimum wage. You would be opposed to that?
I would abolish the minimum wage so that people can get jobs in this country so that they can start someplace. The only way you get a job paying $10 an hour is to first get a job paying $3 an hour or $4 an hour and work your way up. If you cut off that bottom rung and say no one can work for $4 an hour in this country, it's against the law, then those people wind up in welfare for the rest of their lives, and that, I think, is our modern-day form of slavery.
Now, you don't think that would drive the bottom of the wage scales in society even further down?
Oh, no, heavens not. It's wrong to think that employers act under duress and that it is the minimum wage that is going to raise wages. If that were true, we would all be working for the minimum wage. But the fact of the matter is that employers compete with each other to get the best people. And as a result, some people make $6 an hour, some make $10 an hour, some make $50 an hour.
But you're already at a very uneven situation, and you've got more people who are richer now and more people who are poorer, or at least a greater gap than ever between them. So how do you, if you were to set up a situation now where government steps out, that will be exaggerated.
Well, if we use force to try to impose equality on this country, then what we are going to do is to push everybody down. What I want to do is to lift everybody up. I am sick to death of politicians posing as friends of the poor, friends of the blacks, friends of the underprivileged, and so forth, when all they are doing is imposing policies that grind these people under their boots. And that's what's happening in this country, and it's got to stop. It has got to stop. We have got to stop this idea of pretending that government is actually lifting the fortunes of these people, when in fact it is government that is consigning them to hopelessness and despair.
Harry
Mr. Brown, one of the most intriguing aspects of your program is that you would, in essence, call for a return to some isolationism on the part of our government by withdrawing all American troops from abroad and participation in international organizations. Don't you think that this is going counter to the overall globalization of business in society? What would the American business community think if there were not troops stationed in bases all around the world to protect American interests?
Well, the globalization takes place in the minds of politicians. I am for internationalism. I want the borders to be open. I want free trade. I want free immigration. I want people to interact with people all over the world, but I want to get governments to stop making the rules for the rest of us. And if we are responsible for the defense of Europe, then I would like to know what the Europeans are responsible for. Are they responsible for the defense of Asia? Putting American troops all over the world does nothing but create resentment, lead to terrorist acts in this country, consume trillions of dollars, and once again, it doesn't work. We went into Panama to get rid of the drug dealers. Drug dealing is still going on there. We went into Philippines to clear up corruption? It's just as corrupt as ever, and so is Haiti. Everything the American government has done since the end of World War II to try to stop something around the world has not worked, and yet we never look back over our shoulders, and we continue again this let's pretend idea. Let's pretend that American troops overseas make it better for business. Let's pretend that this is bringing world peace. Let's pretend that we're capable of being the world's policeman, and we are not.
Just before we go to our break, this past weekend you had your nominating convention in Washington, D.C. here over Independence Day. How were you nominated? How did the system work?
Delegates are selected from state libertarian conventions, and they come to Washington, where we had our convention this time, and they vote for a presidential candidate. We did have some primaries around the country, and I won all of those rather handily, but they were non-binding on anyone. And when the delegates voted this last Saturday, I got 69% of the vote on the first ballot and gave my acceptance speech on C-SPAN, of which you played a little of the applause in the introduction.
Well, when we come back, we're going to ask you about militias and about whether the Libertarian Party looks like the rest of America. You're listening to Democracy Now. We're talking to the Libertarian presidential candidate, Harry Brown. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here in Washington. Juan Gonzalez joins us in New York. And in our Washington studio, we've got Harry Brown. He is the Libertarian presidential candidate just nominated this weekend here in Washington after the nominating convention of the Libertarian Party. Now, I was taking a look at that convention, and I didn't notice a great diversity of people. I did see one of the people standing up and speaking was an African-American congressional candidate from California. But overall, it was quite a white crowd.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we have not attracted a lot of black people so far, even though I think we provide the only hope for black people in this country who feel that they are being held down the ladder. They are conspired against in every conceivable way. In Washington here, for instance, they have passed this Davis-Bacon Act, and what it does is it says that every federal program, every construction project around the country has to employ union workers. And this was passed originally as a way of keeping blacks from underbidding the union workers. The government always poses as the friend of the minorities and the underprivileged, and yet it is government more than anything else that makes people underprivileged. It makes the people in minorities unable to compete on an equal status with others. Affirmative action, for instance, has destroyed the opportunities for many black people, many women in this country, by simply setting up an impossible situation of litigation and lawsuits that make employers scared to death to hire blacks or women because they're afraid that if those people don't work out and they let them go, they're going to be fired for discrimination of one sort or another.
Mr. Brown, one of the other aspects of your program is you would legalize drugs and you would also eliminate all federal agencies that have any involvement with crime fighting, such as the DEA or the alcohol, firearms, and tobacco. Now, how do you expect, given, again, this international rise, not just of corporations, but of international crime groups, who would be fighting crime on an international level if there were no federal agencies involved with this?
Well, all crime is local. It takes place in the jurisdiction of a police department or a sheriff's department somewhere. And when a criminal crosses state lines or runs across the country trying to escape, states work together to bring those fugitives back through extradition and so on. We do not need federal agencies to do this. And in fact, the founding fathers would be aghast at the idea that there are federal police forces, federal agents going around the country with guns on their hips, invading vitamin stores and and knocking down doors of people on anonymous tips that there is marijuana there or something of this sort. With regard to the war on drugs, I cannot imagine anything, nothing that would reduce crime more dramatically in this country than ending this insane war on drugs, which has really been a war on Americans, a war on the inner cities. Before we had these drug laws, we did not have muggers on the street trying to support a $100 a day habit. We did not have gangs fighting over monopoly territories. We did not have pushers on high school campuses trying to hook kids on drugs. We didn't have drive-by shootings, crack babies, or people ODing on drugs. All of these things developed in the 1960s and thereafter when the federal government got into the war on drugs. If we care anything about our cities, about the inner cities, about the country, about our children, we have to end this insane war on drugs.
What about the military? How do you feel about the military budget?
Well, the military budget is amazing. We have spent trillions of dollars since the end of the Second World War, and yet we are completely vulnerable to any two-bit dictator who can get his hands on a nuclear missile. Washington, D.C. could be bombed out of existence tomorrow morning, and we would have no defense against it because we have no missile defense. What we need to do is to bring American troops home to America. Quit trying to be the world's policeman. Set up a military missile defense, a simple defense that would not require a great deal of money, and then we would no longer need long-range missiles, long-range bombers, a fleet in the Middle East or Southeast Asia trying to intimidate people and say that if you do anything to us, we'll retaliate by killing a million of your civilians. This is not the way to defend America. What we need to do is to make ourselves invulnerable here and have a strong defense on these shores, and then we don't have to be roaming around the world trying to throw our weight around.
What you're espousing is clearly a radical deconstruction of the roles of government in society. How do you expect in an election campaign without any kind of a nationwide political apparatus even to be able to implement any of these changes? You'd have resistance from not only from corporate forces but from other groups in society that feel that in essence you're eliminating whatever protections for their particular interests they might have.
Well, you bring up some very good points, but the trouble is that for 60 years we have been intimidated by the people who are going to stop us from doing what we want. We have to start asking for what we want. If we want the military out of this world policeman business, we have to start asking for it. We have to start demanding it. I have learned all my life that you never get anything unless you ask for it. To give it away before you even start because you say, well, the corporations won't let us or the politicians won't let us is the worst mistake that we could make. Incidentally, we're skimming over a lot of subjects here very lightly. In my book, Why Government Doesn't Work, I go into these in much greater detail, and that book's available in any bookstore called Why Government Doesn't Work.
I'm going to ask you in a second about the ballot in all 50 states, but I want to ask you about the attraction that militias have for the Libertarian Party, or maybe the Libertarian Party has for militias.
Well, I don't know if there is any special attraction there. A lot of them are Republicans. A lot of them are Democrats. I really am not an authority on it because I've never been to a militia meeting, and I've never really investigated it. All I know is what I read in the papers, which means I don't know much of anything at all. And all I know is that there is tremendous anti-government resentment in this country. The way we are going to do something about that is through the political process. People everywhere know that government doesn't work, but they have not had a politician, they have not had a program that would actually implement a change, a dramatic change, and now we bring forward a program by which we can do this.
Will you be on the ballot in all 50 states, Harry Brown?
Yes, we will, and anybody who would like to give me a hand, just call 1-800-272-1776, and we'll send you more information, including how you can help me get into the debates. That's 1-800-272-1776.
How are you going to get into the debates?
We're going to build public opinion over the next few months, get into the polls, and if I'm at 10% in the polls in September, I don't see how they can keep me out. And can you imagine how this would change the character of those debates instead of talking about Bill Clinton's war record and Bob Dole's character? Or Bill Clinton's character and Bob Dole's war record, we'd actually be talking about some fundamental issues for a change.
Do you have a vice presidential running mate?
Yes. Her name is Joanne Jorgensen. She's a businesswoman from South Carolina.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us. Harry Brown has been our guest. He has just been nominated to be the Libertarian presidential candidate on the ballot in all 50 states.
Thank you.
And we'll be back in just a minute talking about Dick Lamb, the former governor of Colorado. Today he is announcing for the Reform Party ticket he will be, hopes to be, their presidential nominee. And we will see what happens. You're listening to Democracy Now!
When the call of the dove can be heard across the land, you'll be there, you'll be there. When the day of deliverance is finally at hand, you'll be there, you'll be there. When the bells of tyranny ring their last, and the long dark night of oppression has passed, and the foghorn of freedom has blown its big blast, you'll be there, buddy, you'll be there. When the hammer of justice rings out all around, you'll be there, you'll be there. When a genderless pronoun has finally been found, you'll be there, you'll be there. When all men have homes and jobs and food and an optimistic attitude, and this nation's no longer completely FU'd, you'll be there, buddy, you'll be there.
Building for the future, building for the future.
When there's chicken in every pot and two phones in every car, you'll be there, yes, you'll be there. When there's Kinko's and Starbucks wherever you are, you'll be there, you'll be there. And when they make that movie of your life and you play yourself and Kim Basinger plays your wife, and she's running right at you and she doesn't have a knife, you'll be there, buddy, you'll be there. And when they make any movie just as good as the book, you'll be there. Yes, you'll be there. And when the French are polite and the British can cook, you'll be there. Oh, you'll be there. When the hopeless hordes have found their voice and a priest can marry the man of his choice, and no one plays bagpipes or quotes from James Joyce, you'll be there. Yes, you'll be there.
Building for the future. Building for the future.
And when our lifestyle is none of Big Brother's concern, you'll be there. Yes, you'll be there.
Building for the future.
And when Dr. Kevorkian three-towered Stern, you'll be there. When compassion reigns from sea to sea and we coexist in peace and dignity, and intolerant people are guillotined immediately, you'll be there, buddy, you'll be there.
'Cause we are building for the future. We are building for the future.
You'll be there, buddy, you'll be there.
The Foreman, Building for the Future, from their CD, Folk Heroes, here on Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez in New York. Juan, before we go on to talk about Dick Lamb, you've been doing a number of interesting columns in the Daily News over the last few weeks. For one, you've been following the Dominican elections, the runoff elections, after coming back from there for the first elections.
Yes. Well, as you probably know by now, last week, the Leonel Fernandez, the candidate of the Dominican Liberation Party, eked out a victory over Jose Francisco Peña Gomez. And basically, I've been covering the elections as a major as a major Caribbean election that has a tremendous impact on future immigration into this country by Dominicans. And it was a depressing time for progressives in the Dominican Republic because Fernandez united with the current president, Balaguer, and got his support in basically defeating the more progressive candidate, Peña Gomez. But I also mentioned in a column just before the election about the former district attorney of Santo Domingo, who was barred from reentering the country by the Balaguer government when she tried to board a plane in Miami last month because she had publicly blasted many of the top people in the Balaguer government for involvement in international drug trafficking. And the Balaguer government did not want her in the country just before the election. And she was trying to go back because she was terminally ill with cancer. And I've also done several pieces on the huge battle in New York State over workmen's compensation, which is occurring throughout the country. But here, it's especially bitter. In fact, the whole New York State budget right now is being currently held up. It's months overdue because Governor Pataki is trying to drive down compensation benefits for workers in New York State and is being resisted by the Democrats in the Assembly. So I've been following that battle because workmen's compensation, in a situation where many of the insurance company executives are making millions of dollars, for instance, the largest workman's comp company in New York State, Travelers, the CEO of Travelers, Sanford Weil, earned $44 million last year in compensation. Another one, Maurice Greenberg, the CEO of American International Group, another of the biggest carriers, earned $32 million in compensation last year. And yet these companies are crying that they're losing money in workman's compensation insurance in the state.
You know, we should say this battle over workers' compensation is leading to the latest budget in the history of New York State. And one of the major issues Governor Pataki had when he ran against Mario Cuomo was how late the budgets came in at Mario Cuomo. And now he's set all records, the Republican governor.
Well, yeah, he promised the business community to lower its costs. So he's got to hold out until he can win some of this fight.
You know, there was a very interesting ad campaign put out by the unions in New York around the workers' compensation issue. It was a very graphic campaign that involved a woman who'd been hurt in a factory. You actually wrote about her.
I'm sorry. I didn't catch what you were saying.
The woman that who is the feature of the ad campaign in New York State,
yes,
to fight for workers' compensation.
Yes, yes. She was a woman who had had both of her hands crushed in a machine and was initially denied full workman's compensation, and she became the focus with both of her crushed hands of an ad campaign by labor groups attempting to embarrass the Pataki administration, and it was very powerful and worked very well, especially in upstate New York. But it's unbelievable what people who are injured on the job have to go through in order to be able to get a mere few hundred dollars a week in workman's compensation in this state, because New York State has one of the lowest workman compensation payouts on a weekly basis to workers of any state in the union.
Juan, talking about injury, what about lethal injury? In fact, the U.S. government just came out with a report, and this is a column that you did today, on the most dangerous jobs in America.
Right. Well, it turns out that the most dangerous job in America is not being a police officer or a firefighter. It's being a cab driver. And the federal government just reported that between 1990 and 92, cab drivers in the country had a homicide rate or a death rate of 22 per 100,000 compared to police at 6 per 100,000. And in fact, New York City was the epicenter of this problem of 140 cab drivers killed on the job in that 3-year period. 120 of them were in New York City. So that the death rate for New York City cab drivers in that period was 57 per 100,000, almost 10 times the rate of death of police officers on the job. And what is the Pataki administration and what are people, some of the Republicans in the state legislature trying to do? Take all the 70,000 New York City cab drivers off of workman's compensation, declare them all individual operators rather than employees, and basically have them get their own insurance, individual insurance, rather than be requiring the cab companies and livery companies and limousine companies to provide them workman's compensation insurance. So it's another attempt to cut the cost of the workman's compensation fund.
Well, Juan, I wish we could go on talking about your pieces. We're going to do it the next time you're on, including the one you wrote about libraries' efforts around this country to bring the internet to people who can't afford to bring it to their own homes. But right now, we're going to move on to Richard Lamm, who is going to be announcing today his candidacy for Perot's Reform Party ticket, his candidacy for president. Today in Colorado, he is scheduled to make that announcement. The Reform Party is the party of Ross Perot and his United We Stand movement that gained strength in the 1992 election cycle. Dick Lamm was on CNN's Inside Politics this weekend to talk about his candidacy and issues facing America.
I feel very strongly that the Democratic Party has in the past been the party of the future. I think when you look at Social Security and Medicare, when you look at the civil rights movement, the women's movement, I think the Democratic Party has always been in the forefront of change. But I feel it's right now looking in the rearview mirror. This country has staggering problems. It's not facing them. I believe also that it's become just simply another special interest party. I think both political parties are controlled by special interest money, and I've had enough of it. You know, the democracy runs on information, and if both political parties are going to run away from what entitlements are going to do, here you've got the Medicare trustees, you know, signaling we got 5 years and it's going to be insolvent. And both political parties are running away from the tougher issues in American future. So the bully pulpit would be enough. But I have to tell you, I think that whoever gets the Reform nomination this time, in this time of maximum disenchantment with American politics, there's a chance. This is the kind of year that anything could happen. Pete Peterson, who is one of my heroes, said it so well. He said, making fiscal sense out of the future of America without taking on entitlements is like trying to clean the garage without removing the Winnebago. I think we've got to come to grips with Medicare, Social Security, and all of the entitlements. I believe, second of all, is we need a reform movement in the United States. It may not be a reform party only. It may be a reform movement, which would really question the political culture of America, how close it is to so many special interests.
And we'll be talking about former Colorado Governor Dick Lamm in just a moment. This is Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's daily grassroots election show. I'm Amy Goodman in Washington. Juan Gonzalez joins us in New York. And we're joined by two guests now to talk about the candidacy of Dick Lamm, the former Colorado governor. He'll be announcing today at about, I think, 12 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, his candidacy on the Reform Party ticket. Esteban Flores joins us. He is professor of ethnic studies at the University of Colorado in Boulder. And we're also joined by Micha Sifri, who is the associate editor of The Nation magazine and editor of the Perot Periodical, an occasional newsletter on the World Wide Web that follows the antics of billionaire Ross Perot and his Reform Party. But I wanted to begin with Professor Flores. You debated Dick Lamm, about a year and a half ago. Can you tell us a little about him?
Sure. The point of departure for our debate was the Proposition 187 legislation, which had just passed in California. Of course, that's the anti-immigrant piece of legislation that would prohibit immigrant children from attending public schools. It would enable teachers and healthcare officials to, and actually require them to, report immigrants to the Immigration and Naturalization Service, et cetera. The focus of that debate then was on whether we should have one of these kinds of pieces of legislation in Colorado. And part of the issue then became, at that debate, whether or not immigrants were using the welfare benefits and other kinds of social services in this country, and ex-Governor Lamb took the position that they were using these services and that for this reason they should be stopped from coming to this country, and we debated that issue, and I took the side opposite his.
What about the issue? I mean, he takes a very extreme stand on immigrants, although it may not seem so extreme now in the mainstream debate on immigration. In the debate, did he call immigrants criminals?
Well, he linked the fact of illegal immigration or undocumented immigration to criminality and to the fact that they overuse health care benefits and social services. My response to that was, I guess, quite pointed, because I drew upon a case whereby an immigrant had come to this country in the 30s and fought in World War II for the United States, and then came back to this country, worked in the steel mills of Pueblo, Colorado, became the vice president of that union, and then was appointed assistant to the president of the Colorado AFL-CIO. He subsequently died in 1988, and because of his contributions to the state of Colorado, his face now adorns the Convention Center of Denver for his contributions to building Colorado. That person was my father, Tim Flores, who came over as an illegal, so-called illegal immigrant, and was, in fact, a colleague of Dick Lamb's. At that point, he did not know that I was Tim Flores' son. But the point I was making was that, in fact, yesterday's undocumented is today's hero in some instances, but more, for the most part, a very a significant part of a society who contributes through their work.
What did Dick Lamb respond?
He was totally surprised. I could just see his face as he gained the recognition that I was linked to Tim Flores, and he had not thought about that, nor had he met me previously to that. And I think it, you know, it drove home the point, and he tried to argue that that's an exceptional case. And most of the research that we do tells us that immigrants, by and large, are part of the labor force and are in the economy. They may be in the sub-economy, but nonetheless, they come here to work, and they don't come here to use our social goods and services.
Mr. Flores, I'm wondering how well known in Colorado is the fact that former Governor Lamb was part of a very obscure think tank that was prided itself on developing Anglo-Saxon pride, a group by the name of WITAN, which was organized by the racist John Tanton, who used to head U.S. English until he was exposed for some of his race suicide theories. As I recall, not only Richard Lamb was part of that group, WITAN, which is for the Old English, Witenagemot, or the Council of Wise Men, but also Dan Stein, Roger Connor, and David Simcox, all of whom went on to be involved with FAIR, the group, the Federation for American Immigration Reform, and also Mr. Gregory Curtis, who is the president of the Laurel Foundation, a group which has financed a lot of racial supremacist books. But Lamb was a part of that, and after becoming governor, then went on to do the 21st Century Fund with another John Tanton venture. Is that widely known in Colorado, or some of his associations with some of these racial supremacists?
For example, at the debate, my debating partner brought up that fact because he'd done some research, and I don't think the public at large was very much aware of that, but it did get published in both the Denver Post and the Rocky Mountain News, the report of the debate, and so that made the news at that particular point. And in fact, when you make that, raise that point, it of course brings up the issue of racism, and Governor Lamb tried to, how would I put it, weasel his way out of that charge, because he argued that in no way is an anti-immigrant stance a racist stance. Yet, you know, documentary evidence that we uncovered, such as the involvement with FAIR, the involvement with Bataan, the involvement with the Laurel Foundation, the involvement with the 20th Century Fund, are all parts of what is clearly linked to an anti-immigrant, the English-only movement, for example, also comes out of that. So I don't think he could sidestep it as easily as he wanted to.
Esteban Flores, what is the immigrant population of Colorado?
We have a fairly small immigrant population. The estimates even given by the Immigration and Naturalization Service have been around 20,000 undocumented. When the Independent Institute, a Golden-based think tank here in Colorado, saw that figure, they tried to inflate it to say that there are 66,000 or so undocumented immigrants. And the fact of the matter is, of course, no one really knows, but it's been linked as a way station, and, of course, we have the problem escalating because in places like Aspen and Vail and the resorts, the people who do the work out there are immigrants. And of course, they can't afford to live in those areas, so it's created some problems in some residential areas.
In addition to being a professor of ethnic studies, you were chosen by the governor to be one of the members of the Board of Health in Colorado?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Now, one of former Governor Dick Lamb's controversial views, in addition to immigration, is health. In 1984, he made that controversial comment that the elderly have a duty to die. What do you make of his health recommendations and his policy when he was governor?
Well, that earned him the title of Governor Gloom. I guess that's where it came from, and it still sticks around here. My sense is that he makes a general argument, and that is that our society can't afford to pay for various kinds of services that is provided, for example, health services or services of other sorts to citizens or even non-citizens, and that because we can't afford to pay for, in the case of the elderly, long-term care, for example, or heroic efforts or costly medical procedures, that, of course, they should just go away and die. That is his argument. And my sense is that it's asking the wrong question. It totally skirts the issue, for example, of a single-payer system whereby we would enable those who need health care to get it, and those who don't have access to be provided it. So I think he argues from a vantage point that is not very popular.
In terms of his immigration time bomb book, I think that was one of the first, really, it came out, I think it was in the mid-70s. It was one of the first major books in a string of anti-immigration books. What was he like as governor in Colorado?
Unfortunately, at that time, I was living outside the state, or fortunately, I don't know how to put that. But he was a strong member of the Democratic Party, as was reported in that excerpt from the news this weekend. And I think considered a mainstream member of the Democratic Party, as I recall. And I think what's going to happen here in Colorado is very interesting because, Senator Campbell, Whitehorse Campbell, has switched allegiances. He was a Democrat, and then he became a Republican, and that upset quite a few people. His staunch supporters were very upset that he switched parties, and I think it leaves a bad taste in people's mouth, and now that Dick Lamb will do the same, it just makes the political scenario that much more uncertain. It makes it seem that a person's political philosophy is vague and uncertain. Now, from what I heard with Lamb say on TV this weekend, he's quite clear that he's tired of the Democratic Party. He's tired of Republican politics, and he wants to have this new Reform Party bear his philosophy. I don't know how well that'll carry over in Colorado. Clinton did win Colorado in the last election, and maybe this would help him further. It's hard to tell at this point.
We're talking to Esteban Flores, professor of ethnic studies, University of Colorado in Boulder. Again, Dick Lamb is going to be announcing his candidacy for the Reform Party ticket presidential nomination. And yesterday, President Clinton was asked about how he felt about that.
I like him very much, and he'll have to do whatever he wants to do, and I hope we have a good, positive debate.
Mika Sifri, you're associate editor of The Nation, and you put out the occasional Perot periodical. Can you put Dick Lamb in the context of the Reform Party?
Well, I've been sitting and listening, and he is in many ways right in the mainstream of, if we can use that word, of what the Reform Party, as Perot has been defining it, is about, certainly on the central issue of entitlement reform. And I think the effect of Lamb trying to get the nomination of the party, and it's important to make a distinction here, they are intending to have a competition to get the Reform Party's nomination. They are mailing out surveys to more than a million members of this party right now, and which mention both Ross Perot and Dick Lamb as potential candidates, and they're asking people to write in who they want, and then they're going to take whoever comes out on that list with anything around 10% or more support and say, you have passed our primary, and now we'd like you to come to our convention and speak to everybody and try and get the support of the Reform Party membership for their presidential nomination. So there is going to be some kind of a competition between Lamb and Perot and other people we still don't know. I think Lamb's effect here is to, and Perot may favor this, it's really not clear what the deal is between him and Perot, but his effect is going to push this issue of entitlement reform, which, by the way, there are very quietly some strong establishment interests that want that issue pushed forward. This is not a protest candidacy, no matter what he says about being sick and tired of the two parties and the extent to which they are bought and paid for by special interests. The cause of entitlement reform, of privatizing Social Security, of cutting back Medicare, Medicaid, this is, we've been seeing this now for almost a generation, a very ongoing push to essentially undo the last foundations of the welfare state. And, we may get distracted by Lamb's positions on some other issues, whether it's immigration, where he has really retrograde positions, though people will be surprised to learn that he's a big supporter of abortion rights. Maybe those two things aren't necessarily contradictory. But I think the central effect of Lamb's candidacy is that it gives the establishment and people in the media who want to push entitlement reform a way to talk up this issue and to force Clinton and Dole to address it and, in a sense, move the whole debate to the right.
Mika Sifri, does anybody really expect Ross Perot to allow anyone else to be a candidate of his party other than him? I mean, it seems given the man's ego and that it would be, he may be playing around with this, but in the end, Perot will actually be the candidate.
Well, I buy that, Juan. I actually talked to Dick Lamb about 6 or 7 weeks ago, before any of this had started to happen, and I actually called him up to ask him why he thought Lowell Weicker, who was another former governor, independent politician, who had toyed with running for the Reform Party nomination, why he had backed down. You might recall Weicker was part of a small group that included Dick Lamb and Paul Tsongas and a few others who have been talking for the last year about how to get their issues out. And Lamb speculated that all Perot was looking for here was a patsy, somebody who would come in, run for the nomination of the Reform Party, give Perot the semblance of a fight. Perot would then, of course, have the majority of support. After all, this is something he's paid for. The whole staff of the Reform Party, except for its volunteers, is employed by Perot. It's hard to believe that if he decides he wants the nomination, that it isn't his to take. But it legitimizes the process. If he has what looks like a real political competitor, they battle it out at the convention. There's a little drama, and I'll venture a prediction. We'll see a Perot-Lamb ticket. And so, you know, it works in Perot's favor to have something like this happen.
And now, are we seeing with both the Reform Party and the Libertarian Party, in essence, a continued differentiation on the right between those who are perhaps extreme to the right in many policy issues but are not comfortable with the religious right that seems to be dominating the Republican Party increasingly?
Yeah, I think that that's part of the split off of this, you know, whatever some people call the radical center, though I'd say many of these people aren't really centrists. And there's no question they're uncomfortable with the intolerance of the religious right. On other issues, it's not clear. Lamb, another surprise, was a supporter of NAFTA. And I'm waiting to see how this will play out. I suspect this may become a reason why Lamb won't get the Reform Party nomination. On the other hand, Perot hasn't been talking much about trade issues lately either. So what is clear is the question we all are wondering about is how are the disaffected voters, and there are millions who are tired of both the Democratic and Republican parties who have not yet stopped voting. What are they going to do? Are they mainly for political reform, which I suspect is what they're for? Are they concerned about things like big business's dominance over our political system? Or are they for something like entitlement reform, which is what a whole segment of big business is pushing for right now?
Mika Sifri, we're going to end on that question. And we want to thank you very much for joining us, Associate Editor at The Nation, editor of the occasional Perot periodical on the World Wide Web. Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin with help from Pat Greenfield and Erica Martinez. Kenneth Mason is our engineer. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Or call our hotline at 202-588-0988. Extension 313, and tell us what you think of the show. I'm Amy Goodman in Washington with Juan Gonzalez in New York. Thanks for listening to Democracy Now!